First Annual Research Symposium on the Late Effects of Poliomyelitis, May 25th to 27th, 1984, held at the Roosevelt Warm Springs Institute for Rehabilitation, Warm Springs, Georgia. Tip K201-4, Neuromuscular Symptoms in Patients with Old Poliomyelitis, Neurological, Virological, and Immunological Studies. Presenter, Marino Stolakis. Motor and Sensory Functioning with Changing Ambient Temperature in Post-Polios, Autonomic and Electrophysiological Correlates. Presenter, Richard L. Bruno.
Stolakis is with us from the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland. And his topic for discussion this afternoon is neuromuscular symptoms in patients with old poliomyelitis, neurological, virological, and immunological studies. And we'll turn the program over to Dr. Stolakis.
Thank you, David. As the previous speakers indicated, it is known for many years that patients with old poliomyelitis develop new neuromuscular symptoms. However, the frequency and the pathogenesis of these symptoms is unknown. During the last 3 years at the NIH, we have been studying patients with old poliomyelitis who have been recruited by us or referred to us because of new neuromuscular symptomatology. Soon after we started the study, we noticed that patients with old polio. Soon after we started the study, we noticed that patients with old polio very often had several neuromuscular complaints, some of which were very specific and others non-specific. And we confirmed that with the preliminary results that we have now with a questionnaire of 2,500 patients with old poliomyelitis that we're studying now. Before we answer the question of how frequent the problem is, we decided to have a close look at 20 patients that we selected to define the clinical symptomatology and look at the possible pathogenetic mechanisms. The patients were admitted to the NIH and were studied extensively. These patients did not have any medical problems and did not have any compression neuropathy or radiculopathy or myopathy. They had just only neuromuscular complaints from the several muscle groups. May I have the first slide, please? Now, as I said before, we evaluated only patients who had new symptoms. We tried to recruit patients who are relatively young, and the age group of patients we studied were between 30 and 50. We looked at the morphology of the recently affected muscles by open muscle biopsy. We test the serum and the spinal fluid for antibodies to several viruses and to poliovirus. We looked at the spinal fluid and the serum immunoglobulins, and we looked for oligoclonal bands in the serum and CSF. In addition, we evaluated the immune status of these patients with routine skin testing by determining the lymphocyte subsets using monoclonal antibodies that define membrane markers for suppressor or helper cells. And we looked for antibodies to neuronal cells in the serum using an immune peroxidase technique. Next slide, please. Oh, I have the button. Where is it? Oh, here it is, yeah. Some of the criteria that under which we selected the patients, all the patients had a credible history of poliomyelitis. We looked at the old records if it was possible. We looked for neighborhood or school epidemics. We tried to elicit a very detailed history of painful febrile acute paralysis. And we selected young patients which were affected during the last epidemics where the diagnosis of poliomyelitis was more accurate. All the patients had a partial recovery of function and a minimum of a 10 to 15 year period of functional stabilization after recovery and after corrective surgery. And of course, all the patients complain of new symptoms. We were able to distinguish two separate groups from this small number of patients that we looked carefully. The first group of patients were those that they had deterioration of functional capacity and subsequent stabilization without new muscle weakness. And I emphasize that. These are patients, they had frequent joint pains, they complained of frequent falling, they had decreased endurance, they have some kind of instability, and they need new braces. When we gave them new braces, or the rehabilitation people examined the patients and they fitted them everything better, or they changed the wheelchair, these patients have remained stable. They have not developed new muscle weakness. And they doing very well. They have probably decreased their work demands, but they have not developed definite clear muscular atrophy or weakness in any specific muscle groups, at least during the 5 years period of since their symptoms began and during our examination. The second group of patients that I will talk extensively is the patients who developed a definite slowly progressive weakness that we have called progressive post-polymyelitis muscular atrophy. These are patients who had new muscle weakness and mild wasting, fasciculations, and muscle pains. None of the patients that we examined developed classic ALS, and none of the patients had apomotor neuron signs. This is to show them the age distribution of the patients, the present age, the average present age of the first group, which included seven patients, was 46. The average age of the second patients, of the second group of patients with late muscular atrophy, was 44.3. The years after the acute polio was 37.7, 36.6, and the duration of new symptoms was 5.4 for the first group and 3.5 for the second group. I included here three patients who had no symptoms at all. These are patients who had old polio but nothing else. It's a small group of patients, three, that I have in this slide. And I have put them there for control, essentially. These are patients with an average age of 31 years after acute polio. This is a complicated slide. The only thing I want to show here is that the patients who had the loss of functional capacity without progressive muscle weakness had, in general, more severe disease to start with. They had almost all of them had involvement of the forelimbs and respiratory involvement or bulbar involvement, whereas the other people, the other group of patients with late progressive spinal muscular atrophy, late progressive post-polymyelitis muscular atrophy, had less severe disease. Now, these are two patients that they were in the same hospital in 1947. This is a patient who had a severe weakness in the lower extremities and definite weakness in the upper extremities. I will show you the course of this patient in a second. Now, this is a patient who had weakness only in the lower extremities. We have confirmed that by the family and by the patient herself, who remember the acute disease. Here she's able to hold the doll. She had normal strength in the upper extremities, as far as we can say, we can determine. Now, this patient now has weakness in the upper extremities, although at that time she had only lower extremity weakness. This is the other patient who, in 1947, had the acute polio. She partially recovered. This is in 1950. She wears the braces. This is 1972. And she has reasonably good strength here in the upper extremities. She has definite weakness in the lower extremities. And here is the patient now. She's in the electric wheelchair. I'm going to concentrate on these 10 patients who developed the late post-polymyelitis muscular atrophy. They had asymmetric and focal, very slowly progressive muscle weakness and wasting. The patients had fasciculations, which we could see, and muscle pain. Now, I want to emphasize the muscle pain because it was a lot of discussion before. Now, muscle pain it can be, of course, non-specific if it is a referred pain from the joint, but muscle pain we see often in neurogenic diseases. Patients with ALS have muscle pains and cramps, and this is a neurogenic pain that I'm describing. It's a muscle pain with a little cramp. We have done a study about 6 years ago at the NIH looking at patients with muscle pains. We looked at we did the muscle biopsy on these patients, and we found mild innervation. So it is a there is a muscle pain related to neurogenic disease. Now, these patients, as I mentioned before, had absence of upper motor neuron signs, and they had no bulbar signs or no sensory deficit, and they had new weakness, which it was in previously unaffected muscles, or muscles that were affected but had recovered completely or incompletely. From the laboratory findings, essentially were all normal. They had normal blood chemistries. The muscle enzymes were normal. The EMG showed denervation, which was active and chronic. And the spinal fluid proteins and immunoglobulins were normal. And specifically, there was no lymphocytosis in the CSF. This is an ADH reaction of a muscle biopsy of a normal individual, which shows the distribution of two fiber types, which, as you see, is a scatter type. And this is a muscle biopsy from a post-polio patient, where you see the grouping of two fiber types. Another thing that we noted in these patients is denervation, which is indicative here from the angulated small fibers. This is a non-specific esterase stain where you can see the small angulated fibers. This is a sign of active denervation. Sometimes, and I emphasize that, when you do an EMG in these patients, you may not pick up any fibrillations or fasciculations or positive sharp waves, maybe normal. We have found that the muscle biopsy sometimes may be more sensitive to pick up early denervation like this one. Now, this is a diagram. It's in a simplistic way to basically to emphasize whatever was said before by the other speakers. Suppose you have a normal in a normal state. There are three normal neurons and the muscle fibers. They innervate. During the acute polio, several of the neurons are affected, and you have denervation. And, of course, the two things can happen, either complete recovery later on, where the two anterior horn cells here innervate and supply a large number of muscle fibers, or partial recovery, as we can see here. Now, as we, several of the speakers I mentioned before, with aging, there are the motor neurons, there is a diminished number of motor neurons. And in addition, it has stated that the sprouting, the ability of the motor neurons to sprout, may diminish with aging. So it is a good possibility that this neuron here, this situation here, where you have two motor neurons that are overworking, maybe with aging, the ability of these neurons to sprout has diminished, and because of the increasing demands, they may not be able to maintain the increased metabolic demands of the periphery, so they may easily affect it, so we may have the denervation that we see here. Certainly, this is and the same thing happened with those with partial recovery. And because these overworking neurons are controlling a large number of muscle function, it's easy to see weakness in these patients. These possibilities certainly are true and can explain very well the new weakness that occurs in muscles that are very weak, or in muscles that they are controlled by neurons that are contiguous to weak ones. It's very difficult, however, that this mechanism can explain the new weakness that we have noticed in muscles that are remote from the weak ones. So it may be some other mechanisms are operating in these patients. The question that has been raised by many people in the past is whether poliomyelitis virus can persist in the CNS. And the answer is yes. Dr. Miller is here. He can make some comments later on. But he has shown very well that the Lansing strain 2 of poliomyelitis virus can cause prolonged infection in mice. There are other there's evidence also that another virus which is similar to polio, the picornum virus, can cause encephalitis, which can be followed by late progressive demyelination. It has been shown also that a persistent poliovirus infection can be caused in mice with immunosuppression. And it is known that chronic progressive poliomyelitis can occur in patients with immunodeficiency. Because of this, we looked in our patients with late progressive post-poliomyelitis muscular atrophy to see whether there is any changes in the immune system, which may justify such a possible persistent infection. The first thing we noticed in the muscle biopsy of these patients is that some of them had lymphorrhizes. This is a lymphorrhize, it's a lymphocytic infiltrate. And lymphorrhizes have been shown before in myasthenia gravis, which is an autoimmune disease. And they may imply sensitized lymphocytes or a cellular immune reaction. In addition, we found some other lymphocytic infiltrates here in another patient. And in some patients, we found this lymphocytic response. This is a non-specific esterase, which has shown that these cells are macrophages. Macrophages are stained with esterase. Now, this kind of picture can be seen when the muscle has been stuck by a needle, like an EMG needle or some kind of an injury. We didn't have any evidence that our patients had been injected by any needle in the where the biopsy was taken from. We then looked at lymphocytes population using the monoclonal antibodies. And I have put here the immunoregulatory ratio, which is the OKT4 to OKT8 ratio. This defines the ratio of suppressor to helper cells. These are the normal controls. I have put here 28 normal controls that we had, and you can see that the immunoregulatory ratio is between 1.3 to around 2.2 to 2.3 in our patients. These are three patients with old polio without new symptoms, and their ratio was normal. These are six patients with old polio, with only functional, with the stabilization of the muscle function, but without new muscle weakness. And two of these patients had an abnormal immunoregulatory ratio with a high level of OKT4 cells, one in two patients. And then when we look at the patients with late progressive post-poliomyelitis muscular atrophy, we can see that two patients are below one, which indicates that there may be some kind of immunodeficiency here, and four or five patients also have a higher ratio, which tells us that there may be some abnormalities with the immunoregulation in these patients. The changes are variable. There's not a well-defined change. In other words, it's not changed on, or is not diminished or increased. It's just a wide spectrum of changes. But nevertheless, they're still out of the normal. In addition, we looked at the spinal fluid immunoglobulins, and as I said, the IgG was normal as well as the IgA. We did not measure the IgM. But we then looked at the agarose gel electrophoresis of the spinal fluid. And here we have a patient with ALS, where we see no abnormal bands in the IgG region. And here is a patient with post-poliomyelitis muscular atrophy, where you see two or three bands in the IgG region. Now, bands in the IgG region indicate that there is an antibody response to some kind of antigenic stimulation. We don't really know at the moment whether this antibody response is to a poliovirus or to a neuronal component. We have not eluted the bands to see whether they react with anything yet. But we were surprised to see that three patients that we examined had abnormal bands in the CSF. Then we decided to look at antibody titers to poliovirus. I should state first that we looked at the antibody titers to several other viruses like measles, rubella, and CMV and EBV, and all were normal in these patients. Then, to look at the poliovirus in the patients, antibodies in patients with all polio, we have to be careful because poliovirus antibodies in the serum are usually elevated in these patients because they had poliomyelitis. In addition, some of these patients have been exposed to other people with polio and may have been immunized with polio. So it's important then to look at the antibody titers to poliovirus in the spinal fluid. So what we did here, we looked at the antibody titers to the, in the serum and in the CSF, and we measured the ratio of serum to CSF antibody titers. In other words, we measured the permeability of the blood-brain barrier, and we wanted to see whether there is a specific elevation of antibodies to poliovirus in the spinal fluid. These are the titers for the polio type 1 virus, polio 2 and polio 3. We looked at six patients, and all six patients, this patient was not done. We looked at six patients. Five patients had normal titers to all the viruses, but this patient had very high titers to all the type of viruses, the polio 1, polio 2 and polio 3. These are very high titers. We have not seen that in these titers in the normals, and we did not see in the other five patients. It was a little unusual that the poliovirus titers to poliovirus were for all the three types of poliovirus. This patient, I should emphasize, has not been immunized for polio. It's only one patient that had high titers, but what we can say from that is that it's an interesting observation. We wanted to look at more patients at the moment, and we wanted to look at these titers with different techniques such as ELISA and radioimmunoassay. In addition, we looked for antibodies to neuronal cells in these patients. To do that, we took the serum from the patients and we applied the serum to spinal cord sections, or to human spinal cord sections, and we checked with immunoperoxidase to see whether the serum contains antibodies to neurons. And we did not find such antibodies in any of the patients. This is sort of a summary of all the immune and viral studies that we did. Some of the patients had abnormal lymphocyte markers. Oligoclonal bands were noted in some patients. Inflammatory response with the lymphorhizes were noted in some other patients. One patient had elevated titers to poliovirus, and anti-neuronal or anti-glial cell antibodies were not noted in any patient. Since before somebody raised the question, what's happening to the upper motor neurons in these patients? We utilized the new technique that we have now at the NIH using a PET scan, which is a positron emission tomography, looking at the metabolic activity of the motor cortex and sensory cortex. We use 2-deoxydiglucose, which is utilized by the nerve cells, and we look at the activity here. This is this is an abnormal scan where you see the red area is the area of normal metabolic activity. The area here are areas of decreased metabolic activity. These areas correspond to motor and probably sensory cortex bilaterally. And this is from a patient with ALS who had upper motor neuron involvement. This is from a patient with post-poliomyelitis muscular atrophy who had significant low motor neuron involvement but no upper motor neuron involvement, and we can see that there is the metabolic activity of the motor sensory cortex is normal. Now, in conclusion, I would like to state that new motor neuron disease can occur in patients with old polyomyelitis, even in previously spared muscles or in muscles remote from the affected ones. The pathogenesis of the late polyomyelitis muscular atrophy is unknown, but immune mechanisms may play a role. Whether a persistent viral infection plays a role in the disease is at the moment unknown. Have the lights on, please. I think what we have been able to define from this limited study with a very small number of patients is that if we're careful, we can distinguish two distinct, clinically defined groups of patients, ones who had the muscle atrophy and wasting and progressive muscle weakness, and another group of patients who do not, at least during the 5 years period that we observe these patients. I don't really know what the mechanism of the first one is, but it may not be very specific for polio. It may be something that we see in many patients with chronic muscle weakness from different causes, that they are staying in the wheelchair or they use crutches. I will stop here. Yes.
Why don't we allow Dr. Miller a second to make a comment, since it was his study that was alluded to?
Isn't much more to say about that, except that it does exist as a model for prolonged infection in animals. Ours were up to about 3 months after. As Dr. Dalakis has also commented, Tyler's virus, which I'm happy to say, he's the first person I know not to say that that's a mouse poliovirus, but a mouse bicornavirus, can run for several years as prolonged infections in the appropriate host. And that's a natural infection. There are a couple of comments about the work in humans. I think, you know, we've already discussed the nosology problems that exist in this disease and or syndrome, and Dr. Dalakis has again pointed out to this, and Dr. Roll and his colleagues in our muscle group at the New York Neurological Institute have also been very interested in these cases where the questions of joint pain and other types of decompensation don't seem to enter into it much, but it seems more to be related to progressive weakness in muscle. We also find that we don't particularly notice neutralization titer elevations out of the range of normal controls in these cases. But going back to the mouse work, I also would like to point out that this is not very conclusive in trying to eliminate the possibility of prolonged infection, because in the mouse studies that both Dr. Jubelt and I did, in acute and in the chronic mice, we do not find increased neutralizing antibody titers in these animals, possibly because the virus is restricted to the central nervous system, which is a relatively privileged site and doesn't cause an antibody stimulus or a re-stimulus following the initial infection if it hasn't been eliminated. The one thing that we have not found is the presence of oligoclonal bands in these patients. And this brings to mind a question whether these patients were also studied with visual evoked responses, because we are looking at a group of patients who in middle life begin to get progressively weaker. And perhaps this could be a myelitis in these instances. This is quite unusual, very exciting if true.
Yeah, well, it was really true. The oligoclonal bands were confirmed twice, because I was excited too when we saw them. These patients did not have signs of myelopathy, but we didn't study them with visual or somatosensory evoked responses or the other kind of electrical, other than the EMG.
Parsons from Denver, you mentioned in your presentation that I think of your 10 patients, none of them had difficulty with bulbar symptoms at the time of your study. Had any of them had bulbar symptoms at the time of their initial onset?
I have to look at the data. I believe only one had bulbar. I believe only one had the bulbar signs, I believe.
Johnson, Columbus. I agree with your note on the name of this, and I think we all ought to settle on something like that. I like a post-polio muscular atrophy, post-polio progressive muscular atrophy, if you wish. But I do have two comments that I think you probably are mistaken on. One is that you said that the sampling technique with muscle biopsy is better than EMG, and obviously that couldn't be true because we can look at every muscle, and you may biopsy two or three or four, but we can beat you out there. Would you agree to that?
No, I agree. What I really I want to show that these small angulated fibers sometimes may not be picked up by the EMG. Maybe the EMG in such a muscle may be normal because there are so few small angulated fibers and they may not really cause any abnormality. But I agree with you. The EMG screens so many muscles.
One last thing, which I think this is a language problem, muscle pain. This is an idiom, perhaps, or parochialism, but we don't use muscle pain specifically to describe cramps, and I think that's what you were talking about. Cramps and fasciculation so common in weak muscles, and I think to make the record clear, we ought to leave it at that, because David and some others were talking about what is referred to in Europe, I believe, as muscular rheumatism. Over here, we call it something else. But that's a clarification of your... I wouldn't put muscle pain there on account of symptoms because it would mislead people, or at least clinicians like us.
I agree. I don't really know what a better term will be. The patients refer to as muscle pain. And, so I think it's not a typical muscle cramp that the patient, like the cramps that we see in metabolic myopathies, is the muscle pain and cramp that we see in ALS, for example, the Charlie horses type. You know. So I don't know what term you like. I'm open to suggestions, whatever term you like to use.
Feldman from Edmonton. I have two comments to make. The first having to do with the last question of your presentation regarding the improvement as a result of bracing. I can't help feeling that maybe what you've done with the bracing is just improve the biomechanical function of the limb that was braced and just delaying perhaps what's a clinical manifestation of further muscle weakness down the road. So you may yet still be in the same process, but we'll find it happening later on.
Certainly. I think that's a good possibility, and maybe that's what may have happened. The distinction I have made is that these patients did not develop clinically, at least, the clear weakness and wasting that the other people have developed with the fasciculation, the focal type of atrophy and weakness. So it may be whatever you suggest, and the bracing sort of just...
The second question I'd like to ask is just how much muscle wasting did you identify? Because you seemed in your presentation to say that it was very little muscle wasting.
Yes.
And then you used the term atrophy. And unlike Dr. Johnson, I have trouble with that unless there's been marked changes in the actual volume of muscle that you were examining.
Well, it's not a significant muscle atrophy. I should, certainly it's true. But it is a definite atrophy when we measure the muscle, the diameter of the muscle, as we follow the patients. And the patients have also told us that a year ago this muscle was bigger and now it's smaller. It's not a very striking muscle atrophy, but it is.
Thank you.
Stola of Seattle. Two quickies. Coming back to muscle pain, was there muscle tenderness as well or not?
Well, the patients described muscle tenderness.
Did you squeeze it and decided it
hurt? Yeah, but it was nothing really.
Nothing really.
We're not impressed.
Second question is, can you PET scan the spinal cord serially?
No. We have done only the upper cut of the spinal cord, close to the foramen magnum, but the resolution is not really good to make any.
Other questions? If not, thank you, Dr. Dalagas. Let us proceed onward then. Dr. Bruno is going to share with us some of the studies he's been involved in looking at these large sensory amplitude potentials as well as the effects of temperature on the post-polio patient.
Sorry you said that, David. I want to first say that I'm not an electromyographer. I am not an electromyographer. I defer all questions about my findings to Dr. Johnson. Since I'm batting cleanup tonight, I think I'd like to pitch you a changeup. I'd like to talk not only about motor functioning, but about sensory functioning and about autonomic functioning in post-polios and possibly an interrelationship between those three factors. It's long been appreciated that post-polios, at least those who live north of Georgia, experience marked decreases in the temperature of their affected limbs with exposure to relatively mild, low ambient temperatures. This decrease in limb temperature is associated with often severe burning pain and color changes, which range from cyanosis and mottling to what has been poetically described as a blend of violet color, varying from reddish violet to a deep, dark blue violet. Both the coldness of the limbs and the pain experienced are tenacious. Hours of warming are often required to raise limb temperature and to relieve the pain. Over the past year, we've interviewed scores of post-polios concerning the effects of cold exposure. They have reported not only cold and painful limbs, but some report a profound hyperesthesia with exposure to cold, where mild, painful stimuli become much more painful and mild, pleasant stimuli become much more pleasant. In addition to the sensory changes, most post-polios report that both manual dexterity and muscle strength decrease noticeably with cold exposure, and further, unfortunately, that all of their cold-related symptoms become more pronounced with aging. It's been suggested that the cold-related decreases in limb temperature are the result of increased tonic and reflex sympathetic arterial vasoconstriction, vasospasm it's often called. This as a result of damage to intermediolateral and postganglionic sympathetic neurons. Since the principal research of my group deals with the study of pain, which is associated with autonomic dysfunction, causalgia for example, we have initiated studies to document autonomic vasomotor activity as well as sensory, motor, and peripheral nerve functioning during cold exposure in post-polios. In this first experiment, five post-polio subjects and age-matched controls were studied. All post-polio subjects had asymmetric upper extremity involvement. They reported 10 to 50% of full function in the left hand and arm as compared to 45 to 95% of full function in the right hand and arm. All reported impaired manual dexterity and markedly cold upper extremities with pain and or hyperesthesia upon exposure to low ambient temperatures. Six parameters were measured in these individuals bilaterally at three different ambient temperatures: digital cutaneous blood flow, near median nerve skin temperature, median motor and sensory nerve conduction latency and amplitude, cutaneous sensitivity to electrical stimulation, and manual dexterity. Cutaneous blood flow was recorded in both index fingers using strain gauge plethysmography. Temperature was measured using thermistors placed over the distal crease of the volar aspect of each wrist to measure near median nerve temperature. Median nerve distal motor onset latencies, sensory peak latencies, and nerve potential amplitudes were measured bilaterally with a Cadwell 7200 electromyograph using standard technique as outlined by Johnson. Motor nerve stimulation was performed orthodromically between the volar aspect of the wrist and the muscle belly of the abductor pollicis brevis. Sensory nerve conduction was performed antidromically between the wrist and ring electrodes placed on the index finger. Stimulus duration was 0.1 milliseconds, and stimulus intensity was varied from 0 milliamps to the point at which a supramaximal response was elicited. During stimulation for the measurement of these electrophysiological parameters, subjects were asked to rate the perceived intensity of each stimulus on a 0 to 10 scale, where 0 was no sensation and 10 was, in quotes, equal to the most intense sensation the subject had ever experienced. Intensity ratings were requested during the sensory nerve measurements only to familiarize the subject with the stimulation and the rating procedures. The ratings obtained during motor nerve measurements were recorded for each hand, regressed on electrical stimulus intensity, and averaged across subjects. The slopes of the regression lines will represent the sensitivity of the subjects to the electrical stimuli, while the x-axis intercept indirectly indicates the stimulus detection threshold. To assess manual dexterity at each of the three ambient temperatures, four subtests of the Jebsen hand function evaluation were administered in the following order. Subjects manipulated small common objects, stacked four plastic checkers, and moved five empty number 303 cans, and then five full number 303 cans containing peeled tomatoes without basil. Each individual task was performed first with the right and then with the left hand. Task completion time was recorded for each hand, and the subjects were videotaped during task performance so that prehensile patterns could be evaluated. The experimental procedure was as follows. The subjects were instructed not to smoke or consume caffeine-containing foods or beverages from 12 hours prior to testing. Testing was performed in a temperature and humidity-controlled environmental control room with subjects clad in a short-sleeved shirt. Ambient temperature was first set at 25 degrees C, and skin temperature was recorded at 5-minute intervals. When skin temperature was constant bilaterally for 5 minutes, baseline blood flow was recorded for 3 minutes. At 25 degrees only, subjects were asked to subtract sevens serially from 300 as rapidly as they could to elicit the cutaneous vasoconstrictor response to mental arithmetic stress. Right then left median sensory and right then left median motor nerve conduction parameters were measured. At this point, all of the transducers and electrodes except for the APB and wrist electrodes were removed. The hands were cleaned with alcohol and the hand function tests were administered. Electrodes and transducers were then reapplied, and the procedure was repeated with ambient temperature set at 30 degrees, and then finally with ambient temperature at 20 degrees C. This temperature exposure sequence from 25 to 30 to 20 was employed to control for the effects of practice on hand function test performance with the repeated testing. Let's look at the blood flow and skin temperature measurement at each ambient temperature. Thank you. In all of the data slides, the mean value of the parameter measured is plotted for each hand in both groups against ambient temperature, which you'll see will decrease from left to right. The open symbols represent the post polios. The closed symbols represent the controls. Triangles represent the left hand, which was the more affected hand in the post polios, and the circles represent the right hand. The open symbols are a little difficult to see. Cutaneous digital blood flow is shown here. You can see that the blood flow decreases significantly with cooling in both the post polios and in the controls. At 30 degrees C, the blood flow was significantly lower in the left, the more affected hand in the post polios, as compared to the right hand of the post polios. Blood flow in the left hand of the post polios was also significantly lower than the flow in either hand in the controls at both 30 degrees and 25 degrees. There was no significant difference in blood flow between the two hands at any temperature in the controls, nor was there a significant difference between the two groups at 20 degrees C. You can see that they all cluster closely together at 20. It should be noted that there was no significant difference between the hands or between the groups with regard to the percentage decrease in blood flow with cooling from 30 degrees down to 20 degrees. Let me say that again. There was no difference between the hands or between the groups with regard to the percentage decrease in blood flow with cooling.
This is the end of side one. Please turn your tape over now to continue listening on side two.